Gathers and everybody rather be together on a Saturday night. Coffee on the stove, the sweet potato pie, and everybody's happy, even grumpy old grandpappy, together on a Saturday night. While you are listening to Shaun of the South, I'm your host tonight, Shaun Dietrich, coming to you on a Saturday night via the podcast airwaves and radio waves all over this fine nation. This episode brought to you by Case Knives, a tradition of my family dating back to my granddaddy, who once said the best cure for idle hands was to build something. Also by WNC Original Music, my buddy Ron Taylor scours the nation for the greatest music you've ever heard, and he does it because he loves music. Visit WNC Original Music today. Special guest tonight, the 2nd South Carolina String Band, playing historic music, and we are taking you to Hannibal, Missouri, the birthplace of Samuel Clemens. Saturday night, you could be doing anything with your life, and instead you're wasting it here with us. I like to think of this podcast more like dental surgery, kind of a little bit painful, but over quickly if done right. Tonight's episode might be outside those guidelines, because tonight kind of excites me. We're talking tonight about Samuel Langhorne Clemens, born 1835, died 1910, but known to all America by his pen name, Mark Twain. He was an American, he was an entrepreneur, he was a publisher, a lecturer, but let's not beat around the bush here. He was the greatest humorist the United States ever produced, and William Faulkner called him the father of American literature. His novels, which are many, are very well recognized by every school child because we all had to read them. But the two that stick out the most are The Adventures of Tom Sawyer in 1876 and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn in 1884, the latter often called the Great American Novel. Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, was raised in Hannibal, Missouri, which later provided a setting for his two novels, Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. And a lot of his stories are kind of based in Hannibal, Missouri. That's where he served an apprenticeship as a printer and worked as a typesetter and contributed articles to the newspaper of his older brother. And it was there where he became a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi River. We have a real special treat for you. Henry Sweets, the curator for the Boyhood Museum of Mark Twain, joins us tonight from Hannibal, Missouri, and describes what it's like to go through Mark Twain's boyhood home. Also with us tonight, the 2nd South Carolina String Band, led by Joe Ewers, a historic band playing historic instruments from the era of Samuel Langhorne Clemens. But before I get to these wonderful people who joined us tonight, I would like to introduce you to some of Mark Twain's written words. An excerpt from Huck Finn. This is chapter 19. Now, before I get started, this is the part where he's drifting down the Mississippi River, and he meets the Duke and the Dolphin, a pair of con men, whom Huck and Jim rescue as these guys are being run out of a river town. The language that is used in this book is pure backwoods Missouri. It's a language that children have totally forgotten. America is totally forgotten. But it's a snapshot from history. Sometimes we'd have that whole river all to ourselves for the longest time. Yonder was the banks and the islands across the water, and maybe a spark, which was a candle in a cabin window. And sometimes on the water you could see a spark or two on a raft or a scow. You know, maybe you could hear a fiddle or a song coming over from one of them crafts. Oh, it's lovely to live on a raft. We had the sky up there, all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them and discuss about whether they was made or only just happened. Well, Jim lied they was made, but I lied they happened. I judged it would have took too long to make so many. Well, Jim said the moon could have laid them like eggs. Well, that looked kind of reasonable, so I didn't say nothing against it. Because I've seen a frog lay most as many, so of course it could be done. Oh, we used to watch the stars that fell, too. See them streak down. Jim lied they got spoiled and was hove out of the nest. Once or twice of a night, we would see a steamboat slipping along in the dark. And now and then, she would belch a whole world of sparks up out of her chimneys. And they would rain down the river and look awful pretty. Then she would turn a corner and her lights would wink out and her powwow would shut off and leave the river still again. And by and by her waves would get to us a long time after she was gone. They'd joggle the raft a bit, and after that, you wouldn't hear nothing, for you couldn't tell how long, except maybe frogs or something. After midnight, the people on shore went to bed, and then for 2 or 3 hours, the shores was black. No more sparks in the cabin windows. Well, these sparks was our clock, and the first one that showed again meant morning was coming, so we hunted a place to hide and tarp right away. Well, one morning about daybreak, I found a canoe, and I crossed over a chute to the main shore. It was only 200 yards, and I paddled about a mile up a creek amongst the cypress woods to see if I couldn't get some berries. Well, just as I was passing a place where a kind of cow path crossed the creek, here comes a couple of men tearing up the path as tight as they could foot it. I thought I was a goner, for when everybody was after anybody, I judged it was me they were after, or maybe Jim. Well, I was about to dig out from there in a hurry, but they was pretty close to me, and then snug out and begged me to save their lives. They said they hadn't been doing nothing, it was being chased for it. There was men and dogs coming. They wanted to jump right in our raft, but I says, mm-mm. Don't do it. I don't hear the dogs and horses yet. So you got time to crowd to the brush and get up the creek a little ways. Then you take to the water and wade down to me and get in. And that'll throw the dogs off the scent. Well, they done it. And as soon as they was aboard, I let out for our towhead. In about 5 or 10 minutes, we heard the dogs and the men way off shouting. We heard them come along toward the creek, but couldn't see them. They seemed to stop and fool around a while. Then as we got further and further away all the time, we couldn't hardly hear them at all. And by the time we had left a mile of woods behind us and struck up the river, everything was quiet. And we paddled over to the towhead and hid in the cottonwoods and was safe. Well, this episode is brought to you by Midnight Shift Coffee, the official coffee of the Pensacola Police Department. A buck from each bag goes to benefit the Riley Foundation, which helps support childhood cancer. Visit MidnightShiftCoffee.com and get a bag today. I'm drinking it right now. Also by Folklore Brewing and Meadery, quite literally the best brew in Alabama. The best brew, the best beer, the best mead. Visit Folklore Brewing and Meadery.com now. How about let's have a song from a second South Carolina string band and take you back to 1835. Join us in the theater of your mind in visiting the boyhood home of Mark Twain. The boyhood home is one of 9 properties that comprise the present Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum Complex. The legendary whitewashed fence of Tom Sawyer borders this property. There are 7 additional museums and buildings as part of this complex. There is the Interpretive Center, the Becky Thatcher House, the Huck Finn House, the J.M. Clemens Justice of the Peace Officer, Grant's Drug Store, the Stoneworks Progress Administration Building, houses a gift shop, and a museum gallery. It's located at 120 North Main Street in Hannibal, Missouri. The museum is an experience. I have been there. And I've got with me today Henry Sweets, the curator of that museum, or the former curator of that museum, that is, who joins me. And one thing I want to know, Henry, is what years did Mark Twain live in Hannibal, Missouri?
Well, Samuel Clemens, the future Mark Twain, was actually born over at Florida, Missouri, about 40 miles away from Hannibal, and his family moved to Hannibal in 1839 when he was 4 years old. And he lived here in Hannibal from age 4 through age 17 and left Hannibal in 1853.
Do we know why he left Hannibal?
Boy, that's a good question to answer. Well, here in Hannibal, Mark Twain's father, John Marshall Clemens, became a justice of the peace and held court sessions. And in late 1846, he was running for a county clerk's position. And early the next year, he rode to Palmyra and was caught in a sleet storm and died. So his father died when Sam Clemens is about 11 years old. And he was taken out of school and apprenticed to a newspaper and started to learning how to set type and to work on a newspaper. His older brother, Orion, had gone to St. Louis and learned the printing trade and came back to Hannibal and started his own newspaper. And Sam switched over to his brother's newspaper and worked with him for several years. And finally, in 1853, he'd kind of had enough of his brother. His brother wasn't paying him any money to put in his pocket. He was just using his labor. And he picked up and left Hannibal and started his travels out in the world at that point.
And where did he go?
Well, Sam Clemens had a sister who had married and moved to St. Louis. And Sam went down and stayed with her to earn enough money to travel to New York City because he'd heard about a World's Fair, we would call it today, the Crystal Palace exhibition that was taking place out there. And so at the ripe age of 17, he traveled by himself to New York City, down to Philadelphia and Washington, and then came back to the Midwest. And while he was gone, his brother moved his mother and his younger brother, Henry, up into Iowa. So when he came back, he rejoined the family for a period of time up in Iowa. But 1853 really ended the Clemens family residence in Hannibal. Then after he made those initial travels, he came back and learned the river and was licensed as a river pilot from St. Louis to New Orleans. And you have to imagine what he was seeing because the river was the main avenue of transportation. And everybody from the richest people down to the poorest slaves were on those steamboats that he was piloting. So he was really exposed to a lot of America at that time, and looking at all the cultures that he saw. He then went west with his brother and was out in the mining areas of Nevada, crossed over to California. He was always traveling and always observing. But when he came to write, the heart of his writings comes back to his experience. When you think of Tom Sawyer, it's written about Hannibal and his growing up here in Hannibal. Huckleberry Finn, again, a story about the river, the people and the cultures along the river. Life on the Mississippi still is the best account of learning to become a river pilot that you will find anywhere. But he also made a trip back to the Mississippi and traveled the length from New Orleans all the way to Minneapolis to gather some information and refresh his memory. And he began to see the failure of Reconstruction during that trip. And this comes out in the book. So he's always looking at society and commenting on it. And it's coming from someone who actually lived it rather than just an outside reporter.
And tell me, how had life along the Mississippi changed from the time he grew up to the time he took that trip?
Well, during that time, the Corps of Engineers had been at work a lot, and there were a lot more wing dams to help control the river. There were levees that he had not seen earlier that were there. They were beginning to try to tame the river, which he pointed out is pretty much an impossible task, but they were working on that. Society-wise, of course, going from his childhood and a slave society that he saw to Reconstruction, where the efforts are being made to keep the former slaves still under control with what became known as the Jim Crow laws. He was seeing how the thoughts that were behind Reconstruction just were not being fulfilled. But he saw a lot of change. And of course, by the time he makes that trip in 1882, railroads were coming in and were taking away a lot of the passenger traffic and freight traffic off the river. So he saw a lot of changes, and a town like Hannibal had now had another 30 years of growing up. So the communities that he saw were vastly different from what he remembered in his earlier days on the river.
What can people expect when they visit Hannibal and they walk them old cobblestone streets? What is a tourist? What do they experience?
Well, I think as people come to Hannibal, they're drawn by Mark Twain, and again, primarily through that book, Tom Sawyer. And they're coming to look for that inspiration that guided Mark Twain's writing. And they're not disappointed, because the physical landmarks are here. The hill that he called Cardiff Hill in the story, where the boys went to play Robin Hood and have their adventures, is the foot of it is about a block from the Mark Twain boyhood home. The Mississippi River is but two blocks away from the boyhood home. The great cave south of town where Tom and Becky explored and got lost in is here. The old cemetery that he writes about, where Tom and Huck went with the dead cat to try to cure Huck's warts, is here. So you can come and see all of these landmarks that he's writing about. As part of our museum, we have the Becky Thatcher house. A real girl, Laura Hawkins, became the model for Becky Thatcher, and we have her house as part of our properties here. We've also reconstructed a house where the Blankenship family lived, with Tom Blankenship being the model for Huckleberry Finn. So you can see some of these houses that are what inspired Mark Twain, as well as all of these landmarks around town.
Well, our guest has been Henry Sweets, former curator of the Mark Twain Boyhood Museum. Henry, I know that you're a Mark Twain fan, but I'd really like to ask, which is your favorite, if you can choose a favorite, Mark Twain Samuel Clemens book?
My favorite of Mark Twain's books is Huckleberry Finn. And the reason I say that is that I have reread it probably 20 to 30 times. And every time I read it, there's something new that you didn't see the time before. And throughout the book, Mark Twain's attack on racism is based on human nature. And human nature doesn't change all that much with time. And you just get a better appreciation for his understanding and depth of knowledge of human nature as you read Huckleberry Finn.
Henry Sweets, former curator of the Mark Twain Boyhood Museum. Look him up online. Visit them if you have time. Henry, thanks for being our guest today.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Sean.
And I guess that leads us to the second South Carolina string band, here to play you a song written during the birth year of Mark Twain. Comes to me in Hartford, Connecticut. Dear Sean, I live in Hartford, Connecticut. I am a big Mark Twain fan, and I just wanted to ask if when you do your show on him, you could read my letter. You see, I discovered Mark Twain after the death of my mother. My mother was a 45-year-old woman who passed suddenly from brain aneurysm. I discovered the writings of Mark Twain, and they cheered me up. They made me feel as though I had a friend in this world, even though he lived many, many years before me. Mark Twain is more than just an American author. He's more than just an American. He's a guy. And I think there's nothing better, Sean, than just being a guy. I wish I could have met him. Maybe one day I will. If you choose to read my letter over the air, please play one for me, a song that would do Mark Twain proud. I fell in love the first time in the fourth grade. Now, this is true. It was the first time I really felt what you would call incurable romance. And it was incurable. It was an incurable romance. But then I was an incurably, I was an incurably weird kid. And I guess I had no choice in the matter but to become a weirdo. After all, I mean, my mother gave me haircuts on the front porch with a pair of horse clippers. And these clippers predated the Civil War. She would touch it up using the eyeball method with a pair of scissors that were about as dull as a spatula. Now, to top it off, I was awkward. I was overweight. The doctor called me chubby. Other people called me husky because, after all, I wore Sears and Roebuck pants bought from the back of the store for the chubby boys called Husky Brand Pants. Red-haired, overweight, freckled. I had a total of 79 freckles on my face. But I was incurably in love with Mark Twain. Now, I'll admit right up front, that's weird, what I just said. So now you understand, I am a weird guy. Now, Mark and I were an unlikely couple. For one thing, I was 9 or 10 years old. And he, by the time I fall in love with him, was pushing 157. He's born in 1835. But from the first time I met him, our relationship just worked. And you can't question things that just work. First story I ever read of his was entitled The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. And I'll never forget it. And the library book was covered in plastic. It had them pages that looked like they were a lot older than your mama because they were kind of brown and yellowed. Now, the tale was ridiculous. It was irreverent. It was slapstick. It was like nothing I'd ever read. It was perfect. And I was so in love with the author that I committed black-hearted thievery. And I stole that book from the library. Oh, yes. It was a sin that I have not repented for yet. But I probably should at some time in my life, or else when I leave this studio, something's going to strike me dead. I just hope it's not a Mack truck. Now, some people probably wouldn't care that much about a story involving jumping frogs. Think about this for a little bit. Would you care about a story involving a jumping frog? Probably not. A lot of people don't. In fact, a lot of people don't even know he wrote that story. They've never heard of it. And to be fair, the story's outdated. It's a little hard to understand because he uses a lot of old language. You know, I read somewhere that today's Americans have a base vocabulary of about 10,000 words, not including the new words that we use, like a photobomb or poop emoji or LOL. The American vocabulary has really gone downhill. Because back in the time of Mark Twain, he's born in 1835, when he published a story about the frog in 1865. In that time, the average American had a base vocabulary of 32,000 words. We have 10. They had 32. Now, we use about 42,000 words like altogether. Like, they really sat people down and asked them to read through the lexicon and name the words they knew. And the people knew about 42,000 words. They asked the people in 1865 to do something very similar. They knew about 80,000 words. Their vocabulary was twice what ours is. Back then, people were shameless about using big, funky words like wherefore and thereupon and betwixt. And they'd use them with totally straight faces. Betwixt. Well, the irony here is that Twain's debut story about frogs came out during a bad year for America. America was betwixt two terrible times in history, which makes his story even more special to me. It was written amidst a national hail. Now, I want you to try to imagine this era. If you want to close your eyes, go ahead, but please don't close your eyes while you're driving. The West was wild still, 1865. Wild as wild can be. People were getting shot as soon as they crossed into ugly territory where there were no laws. And the East was still building their factories. Industrialism was about to kick off hard to fill this world with 9-to-5 work shifts, which is where everybody gets the 9-to-5 school day. They put children in school to accommodate the factory workers. So mankind was getting ready to be imprisoned with industrialization. Pioneers still travel great distances betwixt two places with their families, enduring hardships. They roamed in covered wagons. They hit these untamed trails in search of free Wi-Fi. And all-you-can-eat Alaskan crab leg buffets. It was a time when Lincoln was in office. The Civil War was in full swing, and 620,000 men were dead. Wherefore, the newspapers were always reporting on nothing but bloodbaths and death tolls and body counts. Along the Mississippi River, people were dying of cholera, left and right. There were 4,500 dead in St. Louis. 3,000 in New Orleans. And just when it couldn't get any worse, a guy named Lewis Carroll wrote one of the most creepiest children's books ever published, entitled Alice Must Be Trippin'. Alice in Wonderland. I'm telling you, 1865 was a scary, deadly, depressing, horrific year, and the best-selling children's book read like it could have been penned by Jimi Hendrix. And then just when it couldn't get any worse, Abraham Lincoln got assassinated in the Ford Theater by John Wilkes Booth. Now, you just imagine that year. You think this pandemic's bad, and it is. There ain't nothing good about it. But just imagine 1865. Imagine that one chilly, depressing morning that you toss open the paper and you see these ugly headlines and you're flipping through with your thumb. And then you see this lighthearted story written by a 30-year-old about a frog jumping contest in Calaveras County, California. What is this? You think to yourself. Up until today, this publication has always been about printing articles that were death tolls and explosions and war. But this silly story, it lifts your spirits. It makes you smile. You actually have a good day after reading this story in 1865. I know you're probably thinking, I don't get it. Why are you telling this? Why are you giving me a history lesson? If I wanted history, I'd put my head in a textbook and I'd slam it so many times I had to have reconstructive facial surgery. But there's an important reason I'm telling you this. I'm telling you this because Mark Twain cheered me up the same way he cheered everybody else up a long time ago. Because when I discovered him, I too was living amidst pure hell. My life was in a handbasket going southward. I was in desperate need of goodness, of cheer. Cheer. There is nothing I love more than cheerfulness. And at the time in my life when I really began digging into his work, my life sucked ditch water. My family had no money. My mother worked all the time to pay bills. My father committed suicide, and when someone in your family does that, people sort of blackball you. The word suicide is not a welcome word among rural people. In fact, there are many people who believed, simply because of religious beliefs, that my father had gone straight to hell, and literally, and that meant that his family was mourning a man who was in perdition. Well, during this period of my life, I did a lot of reading. Not because I was smart, because believe me, I ain't. I read because it lifted me. I read because it cheered me. It took me away from this earth. And I read because I was in love with Mark Twain. We had a good thing going on. Now, I recall going back into the recesses of my mind, that reading was really more of a compulsion with me. And I'll admit it, I'm a compulsive guy. I don't mean to be. It just happens. I find one thing I like and it's something I love, and I do it until I'm sick of it. That's how I approached reading. I read so often, my mother got very concerned about me. I was always hiding in my room. I was reading until my eyes went blurry. I could stay hidden for days, only emerging to eat an occasional Hostess product like a Twinkie, or maybe even one of them cake Christmas trees that only came out once a year. Good Lord, those are Little Debbie. I love them things. And then I go back upstairs and I go to my room and I just resume being weird. I read books for my friends, books for my buddies. The years went by and I fell more in love with everything that he wrote. I must have read every book. I would drift off to his perfectly conceived worlds. And I would float on his Mississippi, lying upon his log rafts, gazing at his stars. I would admire the simple beauty of his Becky Thatcher, or I'd watch that Calaveras frog jump in my imagination, and I would have been happy to stay in that world forever. And actually, I tried. But my mother wouldn't have it. You see, in a last-ditch effort to bring me back to reality, my mother devised a grand scheme that would pull me out of my imaginary world and bring me back into the land of the living. It was one of her biggest schemes to date, and I'll never forget it. I think it was one Thursday morning, and it was nice outside. The sun was shining. It had one of those breezes that come through after the sun rises that makes the trees gently sway back and forth, and the birds make them sounds that just sound like they're high on oxygen. It was one of those mornings. And my mother burst into my bedroom, and at the time I was reading a hardbound book, she yanked it from my hand and announced at the top of her voice, "We are going on a trip, and you better hurry and pack because you have 1 hour." And my response was, "What?" She said, "You have 59 minutes now." "Where are we going?" 59 and a half. "Mother, where are we going?" She refused to answer me. This woman had lost her mind. She'd taken 1 week off work. She'd crammed our station wagon full of coolers, beverages, and Hostess products. God bless her. But she offered no other explanations, no hints. She gave no hint at the itinerary. I had no idea where we were going. So, she was downstairs waiting for me on the driveway, and I shoved my clothes into a cardboard suitcase, and I met her there holding that tweed case in front of me. And she looked at me, and she said, "Get in. Got a long way to drive." And so I did. Thereupon, she lodged me and my sister in the front seat, and we drove for what felt like 10 years across a landscape that moved from the Floridian beaches to the lowlands of Little Dixie in Missouri, and then finally to the prairie. We finally arrived at this tiny town called Florida, Missouri. And when my mother pulled into the dusty parking lot, she shut off the car and she looked at me. And she had this look. Lord, it was like she just discovered teeth. And she said, with that big, big grin on her face, "Do you know where we are?" And I just shook my head because Florida, Missouri looks like nothing. She said, "Can't you guess?" But I couldn't. Well, this really ticked my mom off. Mom was already out of the car. She was marching off somewhere. I didn't know what was going on. I leapt out of the front seat to join her, this weird child. My sister stayed in the back seat, and I think she was eating her fourth ding dong, fixing to go on the Twinkies next. After a short walk, my mother and I arrived at this unremarkable stone pillar, the color of limestone, which stood alone in the distance and had a bronze plaque upon it. And I will never forget, upon that plaque were the engraved words that said, "Birthplace of Mark Twain. He cheered and comforted a tired world." In my short lifetime, there have been a few instances in which I could truly say that I have been struck dumb. This was one such instance. All I could do was touch that shiny plaque. And there in that nondescript Missourian backwater, it all made sense to me. And I could see how hard my mother had been trying to reach her sad and awkward and weird, fatherless, wayward, bookworm of a teenage son. And I understood immediately that this was an attempt at saving my life. She wasn't trying to change me. She was trying to help me find something beautiful in a mostly unbeautiful world. And she did. We were standing on the same soil he was born on, and that's what she said. She said, "Do you realize that we're standing on the same soil he was born on?" And she was trying a little too hard to be excited. I don't know that my mother's a huge Mark Twain fan, but she seemed like his most ardent fan that day, like president of his fan club. She was just grinning from ear to ear. "Isn't this great? Isn't this so wonderful?" And all I could do was nod. I just bobbed my head up and down and said, this is great. My mother had taken a week off work, rented cheap motel rooms, driven heaven knows how many hours into the prairie for me. I was overwhelmed. I could not think of anything worthwhile to say in that moment. I mean, my mother had done something that was so special that my words would have only cheapened that moment. I will never forget it. We left Florida and we explored the nearby Missouri town of Hannibal, his hometown. And I saw it all. I saw it all. I saw the caves. I saw the antique houses. I touched a newly whitewashed fence. I watched a riverboat troll into a sunset on the Mississippi horizon. It was a horizon and a river I'd seen a million times in my imagination already. At the end of the day, my mother and I were eating a hamburger on the back of the tailgate of our rusted blue station wagon, tired from the stupor that comes with tourism. And my mama touched my hair with her greasy fingers, and her face was so happy. But her eyes, they were full of tears, and I felt this prickling stinging behind my nose and my eyes when she said, "Sean, no matter what happens in this world, I hope you give every day a chance to be the most beautiful day of your life." Now, for many years, I believed my mother was brilliant for choosing such poignant words and using them as such a pivotal scene in my life. But years later, I learned that my mother had committed black-hearted thievery, for she stole those words from Samuel Clemens. That's our show. We appreciate you tuning in on a Saturday night when you could have been doing anything. It certainly has been a bona fide privilege coming to you like we do each week. My guest this week was Henry Sweets, the former curator of the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum in Hannibal, Missouri. Visit marktwainmuseum.org to learn more about how you can visit the Boyhood Museum located on Hill Street in Hannibal, Missouri, on the west bank of the Mississippi River. It was not just home to Samuel Langhorne Clemens, but also the unsinkable Molly Brown. Look them up. You will not regret it. Thank you also to the 2nd South Carolina String Band for providing us with period-specific music, and to Celia Santamore and Aaron Peters for providing me with some friendship and some biscuit box fiddle this wonderful, wonderful pandemic that we're all experiencing. And if you're experiencing more pandemic than you want to, hey, you're not alone. Adios.